open the Rules Committee today, and with that, we will open a work session on House Bill 2386. And before we actually start looking at taking a vote or even putting the amendment in, I think I'm going to first have Secretary of State come up. We have a couple questions we want to ask about. There's a few things that we want to make sure we're really clear on before we move forward on this bill. And there is an amendment.
Everyone should have an amendment in the packet.
And you should have your amendment in the packet. So we can get a clarification on that portion. We'd also like to have a clarification or a restatement of the fact about the cost with respect to HAVA. And the third thing that I think a few of the people were concerned about was security with regard to how do we make sure that it's secure. So those are the three things. If you would love to answer that, we'd love to hear from you.
Okay, Chairman Roblin, for the record, my name's Dave Franks. I'm the Help America Vote Act and Centralized Voter Registration Manager for the Secretary of State's office. As per the amendment, and I don't have it in front of me, but as I recall, there were a couple things addressed. The first one had to do with saying that the Department of Transportation would provide us with the digital signature from people who have a driver's license or ID card. And, of course, that is critical for our system to get that. And I believe the only other piece in the amendment was moving the date from 2011 to 2010. And we should be able to accomplish that. I think the desire really is to have the online system in place prior to a registration surge for the 2010 May election. And then the next question had to do with HAVA funding on that. This is part of the voter registration system. It has to do with improving the administration of elections, including federal elections, by allowing people to vote or to register to vote in an easy and independent manner. There are other states that have already done this, including Washington and Arizona, and have funded it without any question with HAVA funds.
Thank you. And security.
Is there a specific question, or would you like me to talk about it in
Representative
general?
Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think, Mr. Franks, what I'm looking for is what assurance the public has that, I mean, we're talking about information sharing in a way between two agencies, and we want to be sure that these agencies are using it appropriately and that they aren't holding information. There's a certain paranoia about government knowing too much about you at any central way, and that none of this information is going to be shared, like your driver's license, and how that would work in an internet-based. In other words, how do you actually physically would exchange this information? How you would compare, and then what do you do with what you've gotten? Does that help you?
I think so. The online registration system would be developed as a completely separate system from our existing voter registration system, and it would have a back-end interface that would be secure. And the data from the online registration piece would be taken over the Internet using the security protocols that are available to us, and there's a number of different options we have, and we haven't, you know, decided on which way we would do that, but we'll obviously use the one that is best and fits best with our systems. We currently receive information from the Department of Transportation, motor vehicles, in terms of their address information and their driver's license number and all of that already as part of the HAVA requirement. And those are done on a regular basis through secure transmissions of our networks, and they're closed networks, so no one has access to those. And I would imagine we would get the signature information in that same process. For the information that someone provides to us over the Internet, and they will be providing us their driver's license number so we can have that for comparison, we will use a lot of the protocols that you do, that you see for your online banking and those type of things that are out there and available today. Again, we haven't gone through the design phase of that, so I can't give you all the specifics, but I can tell you we'll do everything in our power to make sure that we do meet all those best practices that are out there and used by those financial-type institutions.
Thank you, Mr. Franks. I wanted to hear that.
Thank you very much. Any other discussion on this bill? Seeing none, Representative Berg.
Mr. Chair, I move the adoption of the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2386 that are dated 2-2409.
Representative Berger has moved that we adopt the amendments to House Bill 2386 or House Bill 2681. Any discussion on the amendments? Seeing none, any disagreement with those amendments? Seeing none, so moved. Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2386 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded.
So inside your book, you should have a copy of the two statements that we have to have before we can move out of bill. And because the COVID is paying for this, the Speaker has given us a letter that indicates that we do not have to send it to Ways and Means. And so Representative Berger has moved House Bill 2386-1, or as amended, to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Did we get that all in there?
And the Ways and Means?
And that the Ways and Means subsequent referral be rescinded. We also have the fiscal and the dash ones. So I think they're all here. I'm very careful about those these days. So with that, any further discussion? Seeing none, we'll take a roll call vote.
Representative Gerard?
Aye.
Representative Gelser?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Nolan?
Excuse?
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Vice Chair Berger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Edwards?
Yes.
Chair Roblin?
Aye. It passes. And thank you, Representative Cannon, for being here.
Thank you.
So we will open a public hearing. Work session, I'm sorry. That's right, so I thought. Yep. We're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2590. We'll have a short description by our administrator.
Thank you, Chair Roblin. The committee, HB 2590, directs the Secretary of State to conduct performance and program audits on tax expenditures. It requires the Secretary of State to adopt rules establishing criteria for audits of tax expenditures. ORS 297.070 currently requires performance and program audits to be conducted of all state departments, boards, commissions, institutions, and state-aided institutions and agencies, utilizing standards established by nationally recognized entities, including the United States General Accounting Office. HB 2590 would add tax expenditures as defined in ORS 291.201 to the list of required performance and program audits. A tax expenditure is defined as any law that, quote, exempts in whole or in part certain persons, income, goods, services, or property from the impact of established taxes, end quote. Tax expenditures include tax exclusions, tax abstractions, tax exemptions, tax deferrals, preferential tax rates, and tax credits. Substantially identical bills were introduced in the 2005 legislative session as SB 964 and in the 2007 legislative session as HB 2001. Hearings were held on each of those bills, but each bill remained in committee at the end of the respective legislative sessions. That's my summary.
Thank you very much. And Barry Pack from Secretary of State's office.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, Barry Pack, Deputy Secretary of State. It's a pleasure to be before you again. House Bill 2590 gives the Secretary of State authority to conduct performance or program audits of tax expenditures, and we have no particular position on this bill, but wanted to address a couple of key points and put a few things on the record for the committee's consideration. When we read this bill, we view it as being permissive in that it allows us to audit any tax expenditure, but it doesn't necessarily require us to conduct such an audit. If this bill became law, we would evaluate performance audits of tax expenditures alongside all the other possible performance audits we may conduct based on our auditor's judgment and including our current assessments of risk. We may decide to audit a particular tax expenditure, or we may decide that other programs have a higher risk or greater potential for savings. We have limited discretionary audit hours that allow us to conduct performance audits. Roughly 60% of our auditing is either statutorily or constitutionally mandated financial auditing. So I wanted to be clear on the record that we would not want passage of this bill to set the expectation that we must conduct audits of tax expenditures, since this would further limit our discretionary audit hours. Having said that, tax expenditures are auditable programs, which is to say that we can examine the costs, usage, financial controls, and verifiable outcomes of a tax expenditure. However, our auditors are no more capable of definitively determining whether or not a particular outcome of a tax expenditure is solely the result of that tax expenditure. No more better able to do that than an economist or a policy analyst or even an agency employee. As an example, Oregon offers a tax exemption to businesses who offer a prescription drug benefit equivalent to Medicare Part D to their employees. And we could audit to determine how many employers are offering that coverage, what the costs are, what the controls are, how many people are using or utilizing that coverage, if there's an increase in the number of employers offering this coverage. All of that our auditors could determine, but we would not be able to say that it was the tax exemption that caused a growth of the number of employers offering that prescription benefit. It could be that the companies were choosing to do it for recruitment and retention purposes, and the tax exemption was an added benefit, but not the sole causation. So that would be one concern that we would have an appropriate level of expectation. Finally, we do have a concern about the language in Section 1, lines 12 through 15 of the bill, which state that rules specifying criteria to be considered for conducting a performance or program audit of a tax expenditure shall establish criteria for measuring specific economic, employment, or other outcomes by which the goals and purposes of a tax expenditure may be objectively measured. Now, as I just stated, this could be a little difficult to establish because we can't say for sure that it was just that one thing that caused an outcome. And our rules are pretty cut and dried in that we audit under generally accepted government accounting practices and standards. It's the yellow book, we call it, or our auditors call it, actually. And again, our concern with this language is that it could set up some unrealistic expectation of any auditor's ability to measure outcomes driven solely by the tax expenditure. So if the committee wanted to move this bill, we would ask to work with the committee and the sponsor of the measure to either eliminate that language or modify it somewhat to account for our concern around that. And with that, I'd be happy to answer questions.
Representative Girard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the past week, the Ways and Means General Government Committee has had the Secretary of State in. So, Barry, I know about 60% of your audits are done in-house. The other 40 are farmed out. Would this be something you would bring in a consultant to audit or try to do in-house?
Mr. Chair, Representative Girard, the 60% figure is our financial auditing that's statutory or constitutionally required. Some of that is contracted out for some of our larger financial audits like the Oregon University System. The majority of our performance audit work we do in-house. I'm trying to think if I know off the top of my head of a performance audit that we've contracted out in the recent history. I can't come up with one. I can check for you. I think we would bring it in-house. The discussion we had with the subcommittee last week was the potential of bringing in outside consultants to help to work alongside our auditors where that made sense, where professional experience or expertise in the given program might benefit the work of our auditors.
Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What's the problem that you're trying to solve with this bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, this bill did not come from the Secretary of State's office, so I couldn't say that I know what problem that we are trying to solve. I wouldn't want to speak for the sponsor of the measure. I think we may actually have the authority to audit tax expenditures constitutionally as it is in if it relates to fiscal determinations of those programs. So not sure if I can really answer your question.
Yes.
Follow up a little on this. It strikes me then that this is a bill trying to find a problem to solve. In which case, if that's what the intention and purpose is, then I would respectfully submit that a better wording in the bill would be to establish a random sample of these accounts, and that X number of a random sample of these accounts be audited on an annual or biannual basis to see whether or not there is a problem that we needed to be looking for to solve. The way it is, we could, and I have no idea of whether there is or isn't a problem. And with no disrespect to the Secretary of State's office, either the current Secretary of State or one 25 years from now, there could be a problem there, but if somehow or another nobody got a call to, you know, their attention, it would still go kind of blindly on down the way. So, generally speaking, I'd prefer not to pass legislation that we're not addressing an issue. But if we think there may be an issue, I'd like to have the legislation addressed some way to find out whether there is an issue.
Thank you. Representative Gelster.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned that the Secretary's office really has no particular position on this bill. And as I'm reading it, I'm having this strange case of deja vu, and I'm wondering if a couple of my colleagues could help me out with this. It seems like we've heard this bill before, but it was last year in our Revenue Committee. And I thought that I recalled the Secretary of State's office testifying at that point that it would be very difficult for them to carry this out because to audit it, you would have to know what the policy purpose of the tax credit or expenditure was. And we don't know. I mean, often we don't put into statute how we would determine whether or not a tax expenditure was meeting its intended purpose. And I believe the way we started to try to address that last session was to create these matrices that the Revenue Committee would continue to reevaluate by putting sunsets on each tax expenditure as we adopt them. So I'm just wondering if my memory is serving me correctly or I just had a crazy dream last night.
Mr. Chief, it was in the statement that you read before that this bill is very similar to the one you're talking about. Representative Edwards, and then,
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I find Representative Gelser's testimony instructive to myself since I didn't serve on the Revenue Committee, but as one that has been concerned about accountability for tax expenditures and that they are doing what the policy purposes of them are to be. And I'm not one that thinks that all tax expenditures are bad. I think there are tax expenditures and there are tax expenditures. And it seems to me that the point of an audit, well, I mean, I guess in response to Representative Jensen's thoughts about it, this being a bill in search of a problem, I mean, I think audits are, I mean, that's why we do audits, is searching for problems. And so I find this interchange interesting and instructive to me to know what it is that the Revenue Committee is doing. Generally, I mean, I'm supportive philosophically of the concept that we have accountability for tax expenditures that we pass. And so whatever the best way to do that is, I'd like to see more of it.
Representative Berger.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was going to make the same point. I think Mr. Pack's comment was instructive about a lot of this would take a lot of economists, and actually there are economists who are staffed to our Revenue Committee who spend an awful lot of time working on this, and we have a case in point, those three members who are here, of, say, the enterprise zone audit that not even these economists can get to. It is so complicated. I shudder to think if the Secretary of State's office tried to wade into those waters, let alone some of the larger tax expenditures such as the federal interest expense deduction or something like that, which technically would be auditable by the Secretary of State under this bill. So I guess I would encourage that the Revenue Committee keep moving forward in our way of trying to address this issue using the economists that we have and looking at these proactively rather than bring in a whole other section of government to duplicate what's really best done through that vehicle.
Representative Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As the other member who's both a member of this committee and a member of the Revenue Committee, I feel like I should say something too, and I would just echo the other comments and note that I don't think Representative Gelser's setup of her recollection or crazy dream last night are necessarily mutually exclusive.
Representative Gelser.
I always appreciate Representative Reed and appreciate this opportunity to say. I always appreciate you, Representative Reed. I think going back to the issue at hand, which I think is a very important one, which is not so much the problem, but the issue of accountability for tax expenditures when we spend them. It's a way that we are spending Oregonians' money. And one of the bills that we're taking up this session in revenue, I don't think we've pushed it out yet, but really aggressively making sure that we have sunsets on every tax expenditure that we have. And I do believe we have a bill that goes through and hits each of the last ones that don't have a sunset on them so that we are getting everything on that sunset schedule, which really does set the Revenue Committee up to be able to track these issues in each one, each time that it comes up, so we can be sure we're spending those dollars appropriately.
Thank you very much. And I guess my comment, and it goes to your testimony, and I appreciate that. We've had a lot of discussions about here, about we pass these tax expenditures, and then we get back this little statement that says about tax expenditures every year, and they look almost like they were the same one for everyone that I've seen. I mean, I look at the reports, and if it's been on for a while, it looks like it's just copied over again. It doesn't look like somebody went and really checked on whether it was. But your statement said we pass a tax expenditure. We expect that because of this tax expenditure, we're going to create 30 jobs, let's say. So you would go out and do an audit, and you would say, yeah, 30 jobs were created. We have no idea whether it had to do with this or what they were other going to do, but there were 30 jobs, and it was in the place that took the tax credit. So 30 jobs were produced. I have no way of knowing whether it's connected to the tax expenditure, but to answer your question, there were 30 jobs. And that is kind of what you said, correct?
Mr. Chair, yes, that's exactly what I said.
So we have a performance audit that was done, but we really have very little way of knowing whether the tax expenditure or some other influence created the outcome, and therefore the performance audit wouldn't necessarily meet the need that I was hoping it would have if I was looking at this. So it would give us a little bit more information, but we could get that from the economists, and we could get that by just sending out and saying, how many jobs do you have now and how many did you have before, and we'd have some information about that as well. Okay. Thank you. I saw that. Any other questions of this witness? Thank you very much. We're going to close our public hearing on 2590. I thank you for that. Now we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2657, and we'll have a short explanation by our administrator.
Thank you, Chair Roblin. Members of the committee, HB 2657 increases the filing fee for candidates for state senator and state representative. It reduces signature requirements for nominating for the nominating petition for the office of state senator and state representative. ORS 249.020 provides that an eligible elector may become a candidate for public office by either A, filing a declaration of candidacy and paying the required filing fee, or B, filing a nominating petition with the required number of signatures. Under current law, which is ORS 249.056, the filing fee for candidates for state senator and state representative is $25. House Bill 2657 proposes to increase that fee to $250. Also under current law, ORS 249.068, 500 signatures are required for a nominating petition for nomination of a state senate or state representative candidate. HB 2657 proposes to reduce the number of required signatures to 250. That's my summary.
Thank you very much. And it appears that we have Representative Bailey here to speak to this. Or should I say Speaker of the Day Bailey?
Or, Mr. Chair, perhaps, did we just appoint him as the auditor of all?
Yeah. We could do that, too.
All the tax managers.
I wear many hats, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jules Bailey, and I have the honor of representing beautiful House District 42 in Inner East Side, Portland, and I thank you for hearing this bill today. I understand that it may be a little out of left field and is probably not the most important bill that you'll hear this session, but it really grew out of conversations that I had with many constituents on the doorstep as I canvassed, as I know many of you did during the election. The point of this bill is to correct an imbalance and a perception of an imbalance, and to make a statement that hard work is more important than money. Currently, as Mr. Watson noted, the requirement is to pay a $25 fee to file for election or to collect 500 signatures. I don't know how many of you have gone through the process of collecting the 500 signatures. That is how I filed for office, and it is quite difficult, actually. It doesn't seem like a high bar, but when you're talking about registered voters of your party who live in your district, who are willing to put pen to paper to sign for you to be on the ballot, not only do you have to reach those voters, talk to them, you have to convince them that it's worth it for them to go to that effort to sign that petition. I think it's an extremely valuable effort. It gives candidates a reason to connect with their voters and to have that conversation with them. But 500 signatures is a very high bar. And as you probably know, there's an error rate. So it usually is around, you end up having to collect around 600 or so just to be safe. And in my particular instance, I was not careful about the form that I used from the Secretary of State's office, and the first 500 signatures were invalid. So I started over and did it again. And so at the end of the day, I'd collected approximately 1,300 signatures from registered voters who were, in my case, Democrats in my district. Shows me to be a little bit more careful. And of those 1,300 signatures, there were pages that were invalidated because my wonderful mother would occasionally get halfway down and then sign the sheet and date it, and then a few more neighbors would want to do it, and they'd sign on. But because those dates were after the date that she'd put down, the whole sheet was invalid. So it's quite a process to go through getting 500 signatures. And if you think about it just in the math, when I was out there knocking every single day, 7 days a week, rain or shine, sleet, snow, as many of you did, and probably you all did, on average, I would get after work about 15 signatures of hard canvassing after work each weekday, and I'd get around 30 on a weekend day out canvassing for about 120 signatures a week of hard canvassing every single day. That takes you to about 600 signatures in 5 weeks of 7 days a week canvassing. For folks who are disabled, for folks who have more rigorous jobs, that's a difficult way to get your name on the ballot. Contrast that to paying $25. It's much easier just to sit back, write the check, and not worry about collecting the signatures. So what this bill does is moves those two bars so that there's more equity and attempts to shift the default. From the default being it's easy to sit back and just pay the fee and be on the ballot, to the default is that it's easier to go out and get the signatures and get on the ballot. If you're willing to put the hard work, it shouldn't matter if you have any money. You can get on the ballot. If you're not willing to put in the work to go out and get the signatures, then the convenience fee is a little bit higher to help pay for the system. Not necessarily convinced that $250 and 250 signatures is necessarily the exact right level, and be open to discussion on that. There's a nice symmetry there. But I think the principle of the bill is reflected in that rebalancing. That's essentially the rationale behind the bill, and I would be happy to take any questions.
Representative Edwards.
Thanks, Representative Bailey, for coming with this bill. As you were talking, it occurred to me that in some of our districts, it's probably more difficult to come up with, because the pool of potential people that can sign the petition is a little less concentrated. Whether it's because we have a few less people of our same party, or just because of the geography of the district. And so my one concern that pops into my mind as you're talking right now is, you know, how does this disparately treat, unfairly treat, a district like Representative Jensen's, where it's the voters per mile is going to be much fewer. So, you know, realistically, collecting those signatures by walking door to door is going to be more difficult. So the filing fee, I would assume, is a more attractive option in a rural district. So why not, instead of raising the filing fee, why not drop the signatures? Because I'm assuming that we're not, a lot of us that are out there trying to get that primary nomination to get on the ballot, it's not because I can't afford the $25 or the $250 if it were raised. It's so that I'm getting out there and I'm talking to voters. So your thoughts about that?
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Edwards, I think that's a good point. I would take a slightly different view of it and say that it actually, in my opinion, and take this with a grain of salt given that I represent one of the most urban districts in the state, in my view, it would advantage people living in rural districts who choose to file by petition. I'm sure none of us would be sitting here today if we hadn't gone out and met voters. And much more than 100 voters or 250 voters or 500 voters. We all met lots of voters and do meet lots of voters. But that initial step of getting on the ballot and that initial step of having your name certified as, yes, you are a bona fide candidate, that process will then happen sooner because you're lowering the signature requirement. And part of the intention of this bill is not only to make it easier to file by petition, but it's also, as I mentioned in my testimony, to change the default so that the first thought is, how do I go out, meet the voters, talk to them, and hear their concerns before filing for office, as opposed to, I'm going to file as fast as I can and pay the fee, so that people's first thought is towards collecting the signatures, and if for some reason they can't do that, then they can avoid that by paying a fee.
Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the thought that went into this bill. I, too, filed by petition, and at the end of that long, arduous journey of collecting all of those signatures, wondered aloud why I hadn't just written the check for $25. And what I found in a district that's not as urban as yours, it was very different than canvassing and going out to talk to voters, because to make it make sense, I had to have some idea of where I was going. Not yet being a candidate, I didn't have access to the tools that would tell me whether I was going to Democrat doors or Republican doors or independent doors. So instead, I was at gatherings and other places. In working with other candidates in my area that are even less dense than my own, they had difficulty collecting enough people to do coffees or town halls or meet and greets. And without you kind of clear town centers or activities where people from that area come from, I really would be worried about even the ability to get 100 signatures or 250 signatures meeting both that same party and district requirement. And then the second question, I wondered if you'd given any thought to how it might impact women that might be interested in running for office who don't have a lot of money. They wouldn't yet have a PAC because they haven't filed. So that fee that you have to pay is your own. You don't have a PAC yet, who may be working and then after work have that obligation of child caring and child rearing that might not allow them to spend many hours collecting signatures. So have you given any thought to how this might impact the access of women to government, given we only have 14 out of 60 women in the House today?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gelser, I couldn't agree more that we need more women in government and that we need an equal balance. My view in putting forward this idea had been that it would be easier in that process for folks to be able to get on the ballot. And again, 250 may be too high, maybe it's 100, maybe, but that we wanted to make it easier for somebody, even if they can only go out on the weekends. Now, I had the flexibility in my job that I could work a full-time day, but I could be out by 5 o'clock, and my wonderful wife allowed me to go out in the evenings, every evening in canvas. And yet, even then, it took me 5 full weeks to get the signatures together. I think a candidate for office is probably going to enter into that race with an expectation that at some point they will need to go out and meet voters. This is a way to induce them to get out and meet those voters and say, you know, you don't necessarily have to put in 7 days a week every single day after work. There are clear challenges for many people, women especially, and men as well, in meeting that, so that if you can only devote, you know, an hour or two a day on the weekends to be able to go out and do that and meet voters, then you could still be able to fulfill this requirement. Now, should we set the dollar amount so high that it becomes a burden for people to file? No, I don't believe so. So 250 may be too high on the dollar amount, but I do think there is an imbalance that needs to be brought closer in alignment.
Can I follow up?
Please.
So I understand the part about making it easier for the signatures. Why default to having the signature gathering be the way to go? I mean, why not lower the number and still keep the fee at $25 so that an individual can choose what the most accessible route to the ballot is for themselves?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gelser, I think in any case the individual can choose. I think when I say default, I mean the default in the individual's mind about what's which way do they want to go. And I think in a democracy, it's extremely important that we create the right incentives for people to be able to get out and do the work to meet the voters. And especially in a day and age when campaign finance reform is a huge problem, where you have a lot of people that run for office and spend a lot of money on indirect communication with people. We want to make sure that there's at least a few people that they're going to get out and meet face-to-face and hear their concerns.
Thank you.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Bailey, Klamath County has approximately 60,000 square miles. It is bigger than the states of Vermont, Connecticut, or Rhode Island. This bill, in my opinion, would discriminate against minority candidates who, if you're a libertarian and you make up 2% of the 66 or 68,000 residents of Klamath County, you're going to have to spend a whole lot more time out there getting signatures than somebody who's a Republican or a Democrat.
Mr. Chair, Representative Guard, that may even be true if you're a Democrat in Klamath County.
Representative, we have no Democrats.
your point is well taken in that the sparsity of the population, both in terms of geography as well as in political persuasion, can make it difficult. If that is the case, for example, in your particular area, clearly that person is running to represent that party, and they have a choice to make about whether or not they want to get out and meet those members of their party. At some point, they're going to have to do it if they want to be part of the system. Again, where that choice lies, I think, is up for debate, but the idea there is that we don't want somebody to be able to kick back in their easy chair, send off a check, and publish their statement in the voter's pamphlet, having never had a face-to-face contact with a voter. That's the principle.
You follow?
Yes.
Representative Bailey, I'm in my fifth term. You don't get reelected unless you get out and see the people. I don't think your bill is necessary, but that's just my opinion. Okay.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gerard, point well taken. I think this was more intended at first-time candidates than first seeking re-election.
Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Bailey, I kind of wish you'd have come forth with this particular proposal 14 years ago. As I reflect over the campaigns that I have been involved in, and just for the record, I paid the fee and I've also done the signature gathering sort of thing. I didn't find the signature gathering that much of a terrible disadvantage. I was retired. And what else are you going to do in Eastern Oregon when it's 115 in the shade? That go around and knock on doors and hope somebody's kind enough to invite you in so you can get a little air conditioning before you have to walk to the next house. But as I think about it, and in my own case, if you had a $250, when I first ran, I ran as a Democrat, and I ran against a five-term incumbent who was very, very popular. And I ran in a district that it was some time before the Last Supper that a Democrat had been elected in that district before.
I'm taking this a little personal,
yeah.
Representative.
I'm sorry, Representative Gordon. Didn't mean to get to where you were busboy, you know. But if I'd have looked at $250 to file, and, you know, I've got this minority leader and his slick Philadelphia lawyer, you know, trying to talk me into running running an absolutely impossible race, and they want me to come up with $250, and then a week or two after I come up with $250, they're going to want another $300 for a voter's pamphlet, and they're going to want a few other sort of things. They're going to want a half a dozen trips down to the valley, and nobody understands how far it is from where I live to Salem. I probably would have said, you know, I really don't need to do that. I have other things I can do with my money that probably would be just as rewarding as that. Sure, they might have agreed to come up with the $250, but that would not have been very smart on their part, and I would not ever accuse Peter Courtney of not being politically savvy. I don't think he would have invested $250 to see me run against Chuck Norris. So I probably wouldn't have run. If I hadn't run at that time, I might have chosen to run the next election, but I probably wouldn't have won, because the benefit of having run an unsuccessful race against a very popular opponent and doing fairly well got me some good credits out there. So, in essence, if you'd have been here 14 years ago and had this bill and pushed it through the legislature, I might have been doing something today that I didn't have to worry about $855 million shortfall in the last 4 months of the year. And somehow that doesn't bother me. I think I could have lived with that. I do think, and both parties, both sides of the aisle, will have this where they'll come down, and it's not always easy to recruit candidates. And I would argue that it's important to recruit candidates. Even in elections like the first one that I ran in, where it was foregone conclusion that I wasn't going to win the race, but the principle of our system is at stake when we have uncontested elections. Yeah, I mean, the people deserve to have some kind of an opportunity to make a choice between A or B. And excuse me, that's my personal philosophy sort of thing. But and we get down into the scurrying around at the end of the campaign, you know, the filing date, and the majority leader and the minority leader, have got a bunch of unfilled seats, and they got a whole bunch of, and they come to these guys, and they got to have $250, or they got to dig in, and they're, you know. And I think we wind up with less people, excuse me, running in those races than we do at the present time. I maybe didn't read this correctly, but I got to pay more to run for the state representative than I do to run for the United States Congress. Did I read the legislation correct? I mean, I'm sure they make more money than I do. If they don't, there is a real serious problem, and it's no doubt why sometimes they don't get all the things done right. I'm not unsympathetic with what you want to do. Because I found personally the going door to door and having to ask somebody to put their name on a piece of paper that it was okay for me to run as their state representative was a pretty intimidating sort of thing to do sometimes. But it also gave a lot of people an opportunity to tell me, it opened it up for them to tell me about things that they thought were important. It may or may not have been important, but the thing is, to them, they thought they were important. I like the idea of people, going door to door or coffee to coffee, getting signatures. I think $250 as a drop-in fee is a little high, and I think I heard that you may be negotiable on that. And I think I hear that you may be negotiable on the numbers, on some of those things. But those are just some of my thoughts, Mr. Chairman, and thank you very much for sharing with me.
So you said 5.5 weeks, but you got 1,300. Signatures. So you could have done that in 2.5 weeks if you'd been more efficient.
Per time, Mr. Chair.
Just want to clarify that for the record to make sure. And you obviously had other people getting your signatures for you.
My mother is a saint, Mr. Chair.
It can be more trouble than it's worth, too, can't it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, I appreciate your comments. I wanted to address really quickly your question embedded there. The bill that came back from Legislative Council, for various reasons, addressed only filing fees for state representative, state senator. So your interpretation of that bill is correct. And may also say for the record, Representative Jensen, that I'm glad I wasn't here 14 years ago to dissuade you from running, where I'm sure we're all very grateful for your service over the last 14 years, and Oregon would be poor without having you here. The principle, I think, is one of do you have to have money to run for office, and do you and what is the value of a conversation, and what is the value of an interaction, and how do you promote a healthy representative democracy? It is certainly not my intention to create a system that discourages having multiple views present on the ballot. And your point is very well taken. the message that I'm receiving back here is that perhaps some more work needs to be done to take a look at the relative levels and perhaps even to look at not changing the fee amount but simply changing the amount of signatures that are required. That's the feedback that I'm hearing. But I think in general, I hope that the message is clear that I'm not trying to make it harder to run for office. I'm trying to make it easier.
Okay. Any further questions? Representative Jensen.
I would hope you that nothing that anyone has said would leave you with the feeling that we thought you were trying to make it harder to run for office. I don't think that's the case. I mean, it certainly wasn't, as far as I'm concerned, the case. I mean, I really appreciate the bill you brought forward and the thought that you put into it.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. We have no one else. Is there anyone else out there dying to come and test? Representative? Mr. Pack, would you like to come for the Secretary of State's office?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, Barry Pack, Deputy Secretary of State. I just wanted to clarify a question that Representative Garrard asked around minor parties and their nominating processes. A candidate for a minor party can either be nominated by their party at a convention or by gathering signatures of individual electors or by what's called an assembly of electors where you gather a body of electors together, but they cannot pay a fee to be nominated. So it's a slightly different situation than the major parties in this bill.
Representative Jensen.
I just wondered if this was a bill put forth by the Secretary of State's office to increase the people in the elections, the number of signatures that they would have to verify before the before each election period.
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, we have enough work as it is. Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Wright.
Barry, how many people in the last election, just off the top of your head, filed a petition versus actually paying the fee?
Mr. Chair, Representative Garrard, I have no idea. Very small, says our staff.
Sure.
I can find out for you, though.
So, along that line, is it, do you believe that the 500 signatures is a pretty high standard, and could that be less and still meet the kind of feeling that we have to have that you went out and met enough people to make you a viable candidate?
From Mr. Secretary Chair,
or would, your own.
Speaking off the cuff, I would say that we require 1,000 signatures to qualify a prospective petition for a statewide initiative. So it's twice as much as is required to represent a House or Senate district. I think we have found 1,000 signatures for a statewide measure to be a significant hurdle, but not one that is insurmountable. I think there's probably room for some movement in the number of signatures required.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions? Seeing none. And is there anyone else, since we got a plethora of hands going up when I offered it the last time? Seeing no one else, we're going to close our public hearing on House Bill 2657, and we're going to open a public hearing on 2667, and I'll have a short explanation by our administrator.
Thank you, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. HB 2667 requires the Secretary of State to verify the residence of each candidate for state office. ORS 249.004 allows a filing officer to verify the validity of the contents of documents filed with that officer under the provisions of ORS Chapter 249. HB 2667 adds a requirement that the Secretary of State shall verify the residence of each candidate for state office. Proponents assert that HB 2667 is a response to a situation where, after the deadline for replacing a candidate on the ballot, a candidate for public office was determined not to reside within the boundaries of the office for which that person was a candidate. And that's my summary.
And with that, we might as well have a candidate from a district that may have happened in. Representative Riley.
Thank you, Chair Rubble, committee members. For the record, Chuck Riley, representative for Hillsborough, Cornelius, and Forest Grove. This bill does a couple of things, and the reason that I particularly submitted this bill is I am the candidate from that district who had an opponent who, after the primary, was discovered to not live in the district. I think it's very unfair to anyone to put all that time and effort and money into an election campaign and then determine that he's not eligible to run. Be much better to find out very quickly before you start your campaign that you're not eligible. The alternative would be a constitutional amendment, which I think is a bit overkill, when what we really need to do is ensure that the candidate actually lives in the district where he's running. The other thing that this does, we've all heard many times over the decades that so-and-so doesn't even live in the district where he represents. And that's, you know, that comes up over and over, and people believe it. And it's unfair to those people to have that rumor hanging over their heads when it's something that we should take care of right away.
Questions of this witness? Representative Edwards.
Thanks, Representative, or thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Riley. I'm thinking through this as you're testifying. So would the Secretary of State, at the time of filing, they could just look on a map and see if that area is clearly within the district, and then only in cases where it's really, like in your district, where it's really, I mean, you're down to, you have to go out to the site to do some sort of verification. Is that what you're kind of envisioning here? So they're not traveling all over the state of Oregon in every single case when you're clearly in the middle of the district.
Chair Roblin, Representative Edwards, what I'm really suggesting is that they wouldn't have to actually go out in probably no cases, because in the case that in my district, it was happened to be found by someone who simply did a precinct map overlay on Google Earth and saw that the house was outside the boundaries of my district. So in most cases, frankly, people are in the middle of their district. So it would be very few cases where they actually have to go out and physically verify.
Representative Berger.
Representative Riley, I appreciate what you're trying to do here, and I'm not being contrary, but the Secretary of State doesn't know where you live unless they look at a Google Earth map.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, what you're suggesting is here that they would have to do that in every case, because just because you send an address doesn't mean the Secretary of State knows that that's right in the middle of the district or not.
Right.
Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yes.
So what you're really suggesting is that they would do it by some sort of a Google Earth map. And I guess my question then is, do they have access to that information, and is there going to be a fiscal on this puppy?
Chair Roblin, Representative Berger, you'd have to ask them if there's going to be a fiscal. My assumption is that there will be a small fiscal, because it is going to require some additional work in the Secretary of State's office. I think it's work that should be done and is worthwhile. I don't think it'll be a big fiscal, because we have mapping facilities available already.
Follow up.
Well, I wonder. My questions are really for the Secretary of State's office, because
they are coming up.
Yeah, because I wonder. We've taken so much of this out of the hands of your local county clerk, who does have maps that are, you know, but I think we've moved. some certification I'm looking for here. Okay, something that protects the candidates. I really agree with you on this. Something that protects candidates that says, I'm running and I'm certified to run here. I guess what I'm looking for is the right vehicle for that and the least expensive vehicle for that and the most direct vehicle for
that. I understand. And Chair Roblin and Representative Berger, I appreciate that. And one of the problems in my particular case was that the county elections office does have maps, but what they have is plat maps. And unfortunately, the Constitution says you have to reside in the district, and the plat maps doesn't show where your house is in your land.
Got it.
My question then is the definition of verify residence. If I have five homes, how do they verify which one is my residence? Because the previous law just says, in a school board election, we had this issue come up. The issue was, the one I say is the one I reside at, is the one I reside at. So, I mean, that's a different kind of verification that we were not talking about. Is that foreseen in this bill? Because the way I read it, it could be any of those kinds of questions, verifying residents.
Chair Roblin, thank you for that. You're absolutely right. You know, the way the language is written, they could interpret it that way, or they could interpret it the way I really meant it, which is... verify that the address that I say I live at is in the district where I say I want to run.
Okay. So you're not trying to verify which house they own, they choose to live in as their residence?
I'm not.
Okay. And that's not quite what the bill says, but that I think that's something we'd have to check if we wanted to move this bill. And we can ask the Secretary of State the same question. Any further questions? Representative Nolan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know if this is a question for Representative Riley, but the conversation seems to raise the question of where the responsibility for the determination rests, whether it rests with the Secretary of State or with the candidate. And I don't know how I... analyze that question, but I understand in the particular case here, the local county elections office had led the candidate to believe one thing, and I certainly would not be, I don't begrudge them taking that voter registration as a determination, but... If I knew I lived that close to the line, I think I'd actually figure it out for myself.
Yep. Chair Roblin, Representative Nolan.
I knew that the line went through my property.
One of the things that I've said is, well, first of all, let me answer your question the best I can. I think that the responsibility lies with the Secretary of State. And the reason I believe that is because they're the ones who said, no, you can't do it. If the responsibility lies with someone else, then I'm not sure what that means. I believe the responsibility lies with the Secretary of State. But to further your comment, I've said many times that when I started to run back in 2002, the first thing I did was I got a set of precinct maps and I put them on my wall and I stuck a pin in my house. And then I started figuring out what I was going to do from there. I knew I had two votes there, but from there I needed to figure out what to do. So the first thing I did was put precinct maps on my wall and stick a pin in my house. So there is some personal responsibility there, but ultimately the responsibility, I think, is with the Secretary of State.
I guess the only thing I would say is I would be careful when you figured you already had two votes. You should always ask. she might run, and then you would... I tend to agree with you on the Secretary of State responsibility, because they are the one that if a person is concerned, any citizen, and they decide and they ask the question, that's who they ask the question of as well, so and find the answer. Though I will tell you that the people who say you should check it out, some of these rural districts, I mean, it's kind of difficult sometimes to tell you exactly where it's going. And so we always, you know, the people who are next to our district on different borders, we're always trying to figure out where does that boundary really exist. And you know, if there's a house nearby, whose is it? So it's not an easy thing to always determine.
The way this was actually found, I understand, is a friend of, actually a supporter of mine, a friend of hers said, I'm not sure if I'm in Chuck's district. I want to be in Chuck's district, but I'm not sure. Would you check? Because I know you like maps. And she did check. And that's how she found out that my opponent didn't live in the district. It was by accident.
Any further questions for this witness? Thank you very much, Representative. And our next, we have a surprise guest that wants to speak, and that's Barry Pack, Texas Deputy Secretary of State.
I thought you were going to say his opponent.
And we do appreciate you.
Mr. Coming Chair, it's always a pleasure. For the record, Barry Pack, Deputy Secretary of State. I'm really here just today because I assumed there were going to be lots of questions and to listen to the good representative's intent of the bill, because as he think he mentioned, the language is simple and therefore perhaps broad and open to interpretation. So we're just beginning to work through how this might get implemented, and I think there are a couple of points that are important to make. First, the process as it exists now, when a candidate files for office with the Secretary of State's office, we send a questionnaire to that candidate's county elections office asking them to verify certain things on their party registration, the length of registration, whether the address is in the district, if the candidate has lived the required period of time in that district, all those things. That then gets sent back to us, and the county is essentially saying, yes, this candidate does qualify, and that is the process. I think one thing that we would consider in this is that we don't have, the Secretary of State's office, does not have a statewide GIS system. Most of the counties do have their own GIS system, so I think it would raise a question as to whether that's a better way to go than to require us to work with a system. We did start doing some initial work on a fiscal to try and explore what the various options would be in terms of cost, and right now one of the best solutions that we're able to identify, and again, this is still, you know, only after a day or two of research, is that the Lane Council of Governments would be able to host this function for us. There would be a one-time setup fee and then a smaller annual fee to do this. We do have about 350 candidates on average, or at least last year, file for state office that would be covered under this bill, so that's a lot of addresses, and we would have to also do this for vacancies that might occur throughout the year. To address some of the other questions about, particularly in some of the rural counties, I think to be cautious, if we have the responsibility of verifying the address in the district, we want to make sure that we have done all of our due diligence and would want to look at latitude and longitude points for the address, because just relying on Google Earth maps may not be the best way. We'd want to be sure that we're doing it the right way. So there would need to be a level of specificity attached to the address so you can actually see where the house is in relation to the map.
Questions? I guess my only question in this particular place, you were not at the office when this last decision was made, but how did they finally verify where the address was? Was it Google Earth, or was it, do we know?
Mr. Chair, I might invite Brenda Bays, our Deputy Elections Director, who was here at the time, to perhaps join me and answer that question.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brenda Bays. I'm the Deputy Director for the Secretary of State Elections Division. It was the placement of the house versus on the property. The actual address of the property was within the district. The house, however, was located on the property where it was on the line of a different district. And when they used Google Earth, is my understanding, and when they laid that over top of the map, you could see that the house was right on the line of the other district.
On the other side of the line.
That's correct.
Mr. Chair. And so based on that, despite the fact that the address was clearly within the district, you ruled that the candidate was not the candidacy was not valid.
Chair Roblem, Representative Berger, that's correct.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Berger.
There's no way a real human being can do this. If their address is in, then they are in. I really question your ruling on this above everything else. And Mr. Chair, I think we're wasting a lot of time here because no human being can do this to this kind of precision. Why should we waste our time with this? I think your ruling is ridiculous, to tell you the truth.
It's been upheld.
I know that.
I think sometimes we have our statutes and our expectations, and we look at it and we think, gosh, it doesn't make sense, but the way you have to rule is based on the laws and the Constitution, and so we end up getting forced into things that don't make any sense.
I understand that, Mr. Chair.
I mean, but I think it's very frustrating.
I mean, if the address is in, Mr. Chair, excuse me, the address he was receiving his ballots to that address, there was nothing except a mapping system that we have only developed in very, very recent memory. We wouldn't even have the technology to determine that in, 5 years ago? And even then it was only a technicality used by the military and very advanced system. So we've kind of painted ourselves into a corner here. I hope we aren't going to be spending the rest of our lives using heavy military technology to determine such things when it seems logical to me that if your address is in the district, you are in the district. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll get off my high horse.
Representative Nolan.
Mr. Chair, they were not my words, but I don't know how an address can exist separated from the particular structure that is the residence. And George Washington, who was a surveyor, could have figured out that that structure was on the other side of the line. You don't need high-tech equipment to do that. It happens to be the easiest way to do it today, but the tools to make that kind of determination have existed since Washington was doing his surveying. So I would give a little more leeway to the staff. And the Constitution says you reside in the district. The residence, the building in which the individual lives, was on the wrong side of the line. I think it was, I suspect, a difficult decision to reach, but I don't know that they had any leeway to do it any other way.
And I guess my thing is I want to commend Representative Riley for bringing this forward because I think it as Greens to try to figure out how do we best answer this problem without charging and costing a lot of money. So we'll check. Any concern about the definition of residence?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think first, to Representative Berger's point, if I may, not only the Constitution, but the statute talks about residence and even contains a provision of what happens if your property crosses jurisdictional lines and where you're to register. It's based on the percentage of assessed value in each county. So I think the statute is pretty specific about residence versus address. And there is a distinction there.
Go ahead.
So I just wanted to point that out and then and leave it at there. I think our biggest concern in moving forward on this bill is the intent of residents versus is it the property is in the district for which the candidate has filed, or are we also then determining whether or not that candidate resides there? Because those are separate. One is a mapping and surveying, as Representative Nolan pointed out, question. The other would require some additional verification from the candidate.
Representative Burrard.
I can't let go of it either. So, the county clerk said the resident, you tell me, because all I know is what I read in the paper, that the residence was legal to run from that district. What caused you to look and to reevaluate whether that was an authentic residence or address?
Mr. Chair, Representative Garrard, as I recall, the Elections Division received a complaint which we were then required to investigate.
Okay.
And if I also remember correctly, that the county elections official recognized that there was a mistake in their database from the coding of the census tractor block that mistakenly put them in the wrong district.
Thank you very much.
I know that they also investigated in my race. My opponent was on the border, and someone made a complaint, and they verified that he lived in my district, which was a nice thing to have done. But I thought, oh, this is going to be a strange one as well.
Be interesting if you lived on a houseboat.
And just don't move it.
That moved.
Representative Jensen.
I'm inclined to be supportive of a good representative from West Salem. In a position on it, a couple of things. Are we going to get down to the point on this that we're going to have to draw that line through the house to determine where the bedroom is so that we know whether which place it is that we're sleeping? We're bordering on, you know, possibly. The other point I would make in relationship to this, for those of us who were around here at that time, will remember that the map was drawn by the Secretary of State. And a certain amount of liability and responsibility goes with the map being drawn by the Secretary of State. Well, not by the legislature this time.
Mr. Chair?
Chair?
Oh, we're going to get up.
Representative Nolan.
If the line between districts goes through the House, someone has to decide, and it ought to be in a clear way, whether the people in that who live in that House are eligible to vote or run in District A or District B. And I actually find comfort in the fact that someone has thought about it already and laid down provisions on how you make that determination so that it is not decided based on the particulars of the individual, but based on an already thought about process.
I would submit that there was probably substantial precedent for the address or for the residency. I would suspect this is not the first time that the elections division or the individual might have been involved in something in the elections process. I don't know that, so I won't, go there. But I do agree with the representative that if there is something that, some decision has to be made on it, and I will accept that a decision has to be made. I think, on a personal basis, and it doesn't make a hoot as far as this committee is concerned what we think, I think the decision was a wrong decision, but then that's
Representative Edwards,
there's a number of Supreme Court cases I feel the same
way. Representative Edwards.
Well, I thank you, Mr. Chair. I didn't hear the case in court, so I'm not going to comment on whether or not the case was properly decided, but I think that underlying a lot of the frustration here is the general sense that the guy got screwed, and because he's been voting in his district and in a particular district and whatnot, and so he thinks that the county's assessment of where he lives and that he's qualified to run in that district is a good one, and not particularly knowledgeable and versed about the particulars of the state statute. And I think that's why it's good that we've got a bill that would clarify that, and so that we're not in this position where people in the general public think that this is a bunch of partisan bickering going on about whether or not somebody is able to run or not. And so I think that we do need to do something here, and I don't know if this language is right or it needs to be refined or not, but some clarity would be good, though, to this situation.
So. Did you want to respond, Representative Riley?
Mr. Chair, just briefly, Representative Riley again. I just wanted to make it clear that that Mr. Dyke had nothing to do with this bill coming forward.
I understand that.
He was not involved in any decision about this bill coming forward. So,
okay.
I wanted to make that clear
right.
because it started to sound like it's about Mr. Dyke, and it isn't about Mr. Dyke. He may have been the reason I came here, but this bill's about something bigger than that.
Now, it is bigger. Representative Garrard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Most land use laws on multiple lots, if you build a house or want to build a house on a line, it really does come down to where the bedroom is in the house. Mm-hmm. And that is what dictates which particular lot that house or residence would be located on. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. And that is used by both the Department of Environmental Quality and the Planning Department to determine exactly the location of a house.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, I'm wondering in terms of I understand the Secretary of State's issue around the definition of residence, and I wonder if there, instead of double-checking GIS maps, if maybe some language around defining a residence might get us out of this in terms of election plot lines, since we do know that a house has to be platted in a certain way, and you could say if the address is in, then the house is considered to be the in by, for election purposes, or some kind of language like that might be a way out of this. Just thinking out loud, instead of having us go to GIS maps and hiring another layer of bureaucracy to check for something that happens and is a serious matter, but I'm looking at them and saying maybe there's some language that we could use in here that would define your address as your residence for purposes of.
If I could respond
yes.
briefly to that, the problem with that, of course, is that the way we set precincts is that they use plat maps. They have in the past, at least, always used plat maps. Now that there's better maps available, that may change, and that may be what should be done. But the plat map shows nothing about where on the plat the residence lies, and addresses have nothing to do with districts. Addresses only have to do with residences. And the fact that a district is overlaid on a plat map does not mean that an address is on one side in one district or the other. It was this particular case, and by the way, it's the second time it's happened in my district. This particular case, the elections office, the county elections office, simply made a mistake. And it was not the first time it happened in my district. My second race in this district, the Libertarian candidate lived in a trailer park, and he registered to run against me, but fortunately, early on, it was discovered he lived on the wrong side of the driveway. So addresses have a specific location, and that is a residence. They have nothing to do with district boundaries.
Well, maybe they should.
Yeah.
Maybe they should.
Representative Jensen.
Thank you. I would like to close all comments that I'm going to make with my thanks to Representative Riley for bringing this bill forward. I do appreciate that, and I appreciate his interest in the process and his commitment to trying to protect and preserve the process. And that's very admirable for us. And I would have to admit that this is a nonpartisan.
It is.
Issue. This has happened on the other side. I remember a state representative who later went on to the United States Congress that had the same problem. Only in that case, the other side won in the argument. So These are always thorny, sticky issues, and unpleasant and unfortunate when they happen. And my hat's off to the representative for his efforts that he's making to correct the problem.
Thank you very much. Any other witnesses? We're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2667. And I do need to appoint a carrier to House Bill 2386. And I'm going to assign Representative Cannon, who's his bill. So. With that, is there any other business that needs to come before the committee? Any announcements people want to make? If none, I adjourn the Committee on Rules. Thank you very much.
It was unfortunate.